one chance in the early stages of a campaign to make a mistake, because we all do, without us blowing it up. But if we find that that mistake, so-called, at first begins to reveal itself as a pattern that tells us something about the character of the person, then we should put them on notice that we intend to use that material in a story.
The late Robert C. Maynard, former editor and publisher of the Oakland Tribune newspaper. Maynard died on August 17, 1993. He was 56. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Next up, we have our Ebony Spectrum features.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. I'm sorry. It's been a long week, and I don't really got a whole lot of sophisticated words for this, but Senator Schumer, don't be a hoe. Hell, who knows? It could have already been a hoe by the time this video comes out, but here's the sticky icky. The people are mad at Senator Schumer out of New York because just a few days ago, he was talking about how House Republicans proposed a continuing resolution bill to prevent a government shutdown, but they did so without any Democratic input whatsoever. And at first, he was very big and bad on Instagram talking about, because there was no Democratic input, you won't have any Democratic votes. But just yesterday, it was seeming as though he folded, like a lawn chair at that. Talking about the government shutdown is exactly what Donald Trump wants. And he may not be wrong about that, because on the one side, a government shutdown could give Trump and Elon Musk the opportunity to gut federal agencies even more, prioritizing the ones they want to keep, or even filling the few seats left with preferred personnel. But on the other hand, this continuing resolution, or CR, would result in Democrats once again being held by the Republican Party. What is a CR, you ask? It's a proposal to stop any foreseen gap in the functioning of federal agencies and provide them with funding to operate for an extended period of time. This one has a funding plan through September, but there are no concrete plans for said funds, and that's dangerous for a duo that's already firing hella people and wasting and or hoarding taxpayer dollars on bullshit. Representative Rosa DeLauro of the House Appropriation Committee says it's not just a simple stopgap that keeps the lights on and doors open. This is the Republican Party handing over the keys to the government and a blank check to Elon Musk and President Trump. Donald Trump himself has already spent $18 million on golfing trips to Florida within his first 54 days in office. He's also wasting taxpayer dollars with his charade of immigration reform, transporting immigrants back and forth to Guantanamo Bay, a facility that doesn't even have the capacity to house the majority of these immigrants, a majority of which are here legally and have no business being rounded up in the first place. And the State Department is conveniently and quietly mulling over a $400 million deal over armored military Tesla trucks while Tesla stock is plummeting. Now, in order for this bill to pass, it needs votes from 8 Democrats. And we're already mad at 10 House Democrats for voting to censure Representative Al Green last week at the joint address. Senator John Fetterman says that you never vote for a shutdown, that that's chaos, and that he will never vote for chaos. Voting for a CR is voting for chaos, dickhead. Just be a man about it. And just last weekend, I gave this whole spiel about how disappointment with the Democratic Party leading to the withdrawal of our support can be misguided. That we have a job and they have a job, and that we're supposed to be working together, that they are responsible for doing all the work while we sit at home literally twiddling our thumbs. But this is some whole shit. And yeah, the Republicans are bullying y'all, but if you want to stop being hoed, maybe stop being a hoe. Senator Angela also Brooks isn't being a hoe. Bernie Sanders isn't being a hoe. Van Hollen, Chris Murphy, Hakeem Jeffries, AOC, the list goes on. I just hope y'all left Senator Schumer up there by himself. I had a whole episode written about special elections in Florida to help flip the House, but she has hit the fan twice with Democrats in 1 week, and y'all can't sit still for one moment just to let us trust y'all a little bit. And while we're here, let's talk about it for just a second, because I don't trust y'all. Not as a conglomerate. Wouldn't trust some of y'all to teach your toddlers to cover your mouth when they sneeze. However, I am expecting you to act like you know somebody that knows somebody that knows something about being being a good partner and working with the American people. There is one whole Republican senator, Senator Rand Paul, who said last week that he's going to refuse to vote on the plan unless it outlines the cuts led by Elon Musk. How he got more backbone than the people in the literal opposing party. I don't know, maybe I need to change the music you're listening to. Put on Real Big by Manny Fresh. Knock a Few Bucks by Crime Mob. A little trap music in the morning does wonders. But no, real shit. The economy is tanking because of our president's erratic behavior. Firing people, throwing up tariffs left and right, taking them down when he feel like it just as quickly. And this current CR would effectually increase groceries, cuts to health care, to education, care for veterans. And at this rate, a 12-month recession is on the way for sure. Down. So it's still both and. We got to get them seats in Florida on April 1st. We'll talk about it next week. All right, bye.
Next up here is Don Lemon.
Now, for the folks who are asking, what did you ask about the Jewish students? Of course I'm thinking about the Jewish students on campus. Of course, I'm thinking about them. So let's hear from a Jewish person who understands the nuances of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and also being a Jewish person. He's not so far from college age. He's a pretty young man. John Lovitz, make sure you play from the very beginning, please.
Me to put on my Jew hat for a moment. This is an accident. I'm actually wearing a deli hat, so it is. I'm literally wearing a Jew hat today. Let's say that this person had a bunch of anti-Semitic comments. Protected. Anti-Semitism is protected speech. I don't like it. I don't like a lot of what I heard at some of these protests that I do think go from anti-Zionism into pure anti-Semitism on the regular. But like to see the Anti-Defamation League put out a comment with this sort of to be sure at the end about everyone deserving due process, but ultimately coming down on the side of what the Trump administration is doing is so fucking stupid. The idea that like be a kind of patron to what Trump's doing, be like a good Jew who supports the regime, that'll protect us in the end. The thing that like protects Jewish people from anti-Semitism is the culture of freedom, a legal order that protects freedom, including the freedom of green card holders, not just citizens, but non-citizens in this country. That protection is ultimately what makes Jews safe in America. The idea that going down a road in which people think it is defensible for the Trump administration to come knocking on somebody's door who has not been accused of a crime to revoke their immigration status for speech and protests you don't like, it's obviously morally reprehensible, but it is so fucking stupid in the long term. That makes every Jewish person in America less safe. Think about the road we're going on. It's like there are posters in the schools. They say first they came for the socialists. Yep. What do they think comes after that? And then they were cool? Like, it's so stupid. It's so obvious. And like, there's all these people that have pretended to care about history and to learn from history and think about history. And it's happening right in front of our faces. And they're too either cynical or naive to realize that they're the people not doing the right thing in the moment when they're supposed to.
Thank you very much. Did you guys understand that everything has nuance? Everything, there's a nuance to everything, and you can be Jewish and understand that. I don't agree with them. But I think he has a right to due process and a right to freedom of speech. I want to bring in Dave Ehrenberg. He is an American politician, serves as a state attorney of Palm Beach County, Florida, 2013 to 2025. Also, we call him the Florida Lawman.
Thanks, man. It's great to be back with you, Don.
Yeah. Good to be back. Lemon Law. This case is really bothering me. It's got me down. It's really thrown me off kilter. What's happening here?
Well, here's the thing. What this guy is in jeopardy of being deported for is that he may have been espousing support for a terrorist organization. And under the law, it says that, according to the law, I'm going to read it for you here. The Immigration Nationality Act, it says that you're allowed to deport any alien who endorses or espouses terrorist activity or persuades others to endorse or espouse terrorist activity or support a terrorist organization. Now, it is a pretty broad sentence there, but does the administration have legitimate grounds to win this in the courts that he would be deported? Yes. And I know people say, well, First Amendment rights. Yeah. But people on green cards don't have the same exact First Amendment rights as
Dave. I agree with you on that. But where's the evidence? Why haven't they charged him with anything? Where is the evidence that he has ties to Hamas?
Right.
Or a terrorist organization?
Well, first off, you don't have to have a crime to be deported, right? So the fact that he's not charged with a crime does not matter. It matters what he does and includes what he says. Well, people say First Amendment, look at his actions, not his words. Well, you can look at his words as well. And Don, that's where I keep an open mind, because I want to see exactly what he did and said. I know that for Jewish students at Columbia who are threatened and hassled and couldn't go to school because of guys like this, they probably are breathing a sigh of relief that he's no longer around to terrorize them. But whether that's deportable or not, I think that's for a judge. And that's where he does have due process rights. He has not been deported. He's going to go see a judge, and this will be settled in the courts.
Okay, so those due process rights, that means they can arrest him and detain him before they decide on what they're even charging him with or what they want to deport him for? Can they just say, hey, I imagine if you're on a visa or whatever, they can just tell you to leave anytime for no reason or whatever. They can make up a reason, but he does not. Doesn't he have due process rights as someone who has a green card as a permanent resident?
He does. He does. But you don't have to be charged or convicted of a crime to be sent home based on the specific wording of the Immigration Nationality Act. Also, there's another provision that Marco Rubio is referring to as Secretary of State that does give the Secretary of State broad power to deport someone who is a threat to our national security. But you've got to have the goods. You've got to have evidence that he has expressed support for Hamas, or he's done something that exhibits support for Hamas. And so, or is part of a terrorist group. Now, I don't know all the details about it, but that's why this is not, as like your last speaker was very passionate about it. I get it. But this is not so cut and dry. This guy has done some really bad things, okay? He has been terrorizing Jewish students on campus. Whether or not that's deportable, well, let's see.
Well, I want to know, is there evidence that he has been terrorizing Jewish students? Is there evidence that he has ties to Hamas, or that he is a Hamas sympathizer? That's what I think everyone is asking. And so far, Marco Rubio or Tom Homan or no one has actually shown any evidence. That is what people are concerned about. And I've said here, if you show me some evidence that any of this is true, then I'll say, okay, fine. But if someone tries to detain me and they say, Don, we're coming to pick you up, and I would say, well, on what grounds are you picking me up? They don't have to show evidence on what grounds that they're picking me up and they're detaining me. It seems like that would just be a basic right of an American citizen, or even one who is here on a...
That's the difference. He's not an American citizen. He's here on a green card, and he's subject to the rights and responsibilities of those on a green card. And if you espouse support for a terrorist organization or espouse views that are in line with Hamas, you could be deported for that. And just a matter of how aggressive the INS officials want to be. And this administration is getting very aggressive. And I don't know if he has ties to Hamas, but you ask.
Well, that's the thing you're saying. If you espouse views and you don't know, that's the whole point. It says he is a legal permanent resident and he has a green card. And so that's the thing. Where is the evidence that this has happened? If there is evidence that he did that, I would say, Dave, you're right, 100%. But where's the evidence? And the judge has stopped him from being deported. Where is that evidence? Why didn't they present that evidence? Why aren't they not presenting that evidence to the American people right now?
Well, they don't have to present it to the American people. They have to present it to a judge. And the judge is going to make that decision based on the evidence. So you're right that they have to come up with the goods. And as far as whether or not he has intimidated and threatened and terrorized Jewish students, which, by the way, that in itself is not necessarily deportable. That to me, it just shows that he's not a good guy. But I've spoken to several students from Columbia, and they have felt very intimidated on campus, where the encampments and their classes.
Dave, I understand that, but that's not the point. And I have been on college campuses for protests here, and when I was a student, and I have been very uncomfortable on college campuses.
Right.
I would not want the people who made me uncomfortable on college campuses picked up and deported because I did not agree with them or because they blocked me from class. Now, if they threatened my being, okay, that's something else. But because someone blocked you from class, okay, yeah, you want to go to class. But that is not like it is a crime that is beyond the pale. It is something that a college student is doing. College students, I believe, should be given wide berth. And to be allowed to push and to test the system. So I just don't know if I agree with you about that. Now, the law is the law. and whatever the judge decides.
Right.
But I think that at this point, if you are going to pick someone up and you are going to detain them, then you need to tell them and you need to show the evidence. And it appears to me right now there is no evidence. Otherwise, they would have showed the government and they would have said, hey, this is the evidence we have. And boom. Now, Marco Rubio is saying this is not about free speech. Tom Homan is saying this is about free speech. Somebody's lying somewhere. Someone doesn't have their story together, because if they had the goods, they would have presented it by now. The judge is saying, bring me some evidence.
Right.
And so it's up. So something is not right in the detaining of this person. Shouldn't, before you detain someone, you have the evidence for what you're saying, and not just, well, he might be and he could have done this and maybe he's a sympathizer and maybe he's not. Shouldn't it be like, he's a sympathizer on June such and such of 2024, he did this and said this at a rally, which is of concern to the students and the American people. On May whatever 2024, he blocked this student from going to class. He was leading a protest that stopped the students. I'm not seeing it, Dave. I'm sorry. I hate to disagree with you on this. I know the law is the law, but I hate to disagree with you.
Well, I don't know if we're totally disagreeing, Don, in that I'm waiting to see the evidence too. I'm not saying they don't have it or they do have it, because they're going to have to present it to a judge to deport him. They can't deport him unless they have something specific. And
you're saying they don't have to have that evidence before they detain someone?
Well, yeah. Well, as immigration goes, there's very broad authority for the president, the secretary of state. For example, the Immigration Naturalization Act actually says that the president can suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens who are deemed to be detrimental to the interests of the United States, and they can impose upon them any restrictions that the president may deem to be appropriate. So there is broad power. And with Marco Rubio is saying, it's not about free speech. It's about this guy is a threat to our national security.
That is, you're giving me hypotheticals, and you're saying that if there's, what is deemed to be detriment to the United States?
Hold on.
How is that deemed to be detrimental to the United States when we thrive on free speech and people having dissenting opinions? That's part of the fabric of America that we espouse and that we love. Because we want people who, freedom of religion, people have different ideas about political parties. So how is that deemed to be detrimental to the United States? Because you are expressing a First Amendment right that American citizens express, that is expressed here in America.
If it's just his speech about his opposing a two-state solution, he wants the elimination of Israel, that's not going to be enough to deport him. What would be enough is if he endorsed October 7th and Hamas. If you endorse October 7th and say that it should happen again, then yes, then you should.
I agree with you 100%. 100% I agree with you. But where's the evidence? That's what I'm asking you. Before, if someone came to pick up Dave Ehrenberg and detain you, what would you say to them? Why?
Well, I'm different because I'm a U.S. citizen. This guy is not a U.S. citizen.
I'm asking you, but wouldn't you say what? Why?
I would say, what are the charges? But that's different than if I'm on a green card where you can detain people because they're deemed to be a threat to the United States. Now, you have to come up with the goods. And that's why you have a judge and you're going to have hearings. So I don't think we're that far off. Because
if they're deemed to be a threat of the United States, Dave, what I'm trying to tell you is that where is the evidence of him deemed to be a threat of the United States? Why are we picking
the United States or someone who's espoused support for a terrorist organization? So if you go ahead and you say, let's have another October 7th, then that would be enough.
Okay, but I just said that to you. If you said on June whatever, he said that he was in support of October 7th. But where is that?
Well, like I said, it's going to have to be proven to a court or else he's not going to be deported. But the question is, should the United States government, do they have the power to do this? The answer is yes. And can they do it for this guy? Well, the devil's in the detail.
Should they do it?
Should they do it? It depends on
the evidence. Are you okay with people just being picked up on just the suspicion of something with no evidence?
Oh, no evidence? If they had no evidence, then they wouldn't have picked him up. They picked him up because he was the leader of these infamous campus protests that Jewish students felt were threatening to them and universally are seen as something that are that is not in line with American values. Yeah, I'm telling you, man.
That's no evidence of that because you disagree with someone. There's no evidence that they are espousing terrorism or have links to terrorism.
There's
no evidence. Now, if he had said the things that you said, okay, mm-hmm. great. But
that's what the hearing is for.
Send me a speech.
But that's what the hearing is for. And obviously, he's already seen a judge. He's got due process. So when you say he's being arrested, first of all, he's not being arrested. He's on a green card. He's on an immigration hold. And he could be deported because they have to show that he is someone who is a danger to the national security of the United States or someone who's espousing support for terrorist organizations. So I assume that the time that they got him, they have enough evidence. And as far as whether we're going to see it, we're going to have to see it or else he's going to stay in the country.
Okay, Dave, you've been doing this for a long time. Do you know of people that have been picked up without any evidence on the suspicion of something and there is no evidence that it's actually there? Has that ever happened? Because you said they must have the evidence, otherwise they would not have done it.
Yeah, of course they've got to have some evidence. They can't just do it based on the fact that he hates Israel or even the fact that he posts anti-Semitic stuff on social media, which he does, but that's not enough to deport. That's just enough for me to think he's a bad dude. So I'm the one saying that the government has broad powers to keep him and deport him, and then they have to provide evidence. So we're not that far off. I guess you would be a little less willing to use the government's powers to...
Well, I'm a little different because of my interactions, perhaps, with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Because I know people and have been... People say this is suspicious when they have had no evidence. You are doing this. You are acting suspiciously as someone who has been racially profiled in a store, right? In a retail store with no actual evidence of anything happening. People just sort of walking around and following me and then calling the police when I have a receipt in my pocket. Mm-hmm. So to say that someone is because there is a suspicion of something that someone automatically has the evidence, for me, honestly, as a black person, that is bullshit. Because there is no, I've had the cops called on me for shoplifting, Dave, when I had a receipt in my pocket. There was no evidence except in someone's mind, I was suspicious. And so I cannot believe that you are here as a member of, you know, the courts and the law enforcement saying they must have evidence or otherwise they would not have done it. I'm sorry, that's hard for me to swallow. I don't get it. I want to know when you arrest me or detain me, where is the evidence that I am guilty of what you are accusing me of? Otherwise, I don't feel, and perhaps I'm not within the law, that you have the right to detain me unless you have some hard evidence that you are going to show in court in a due process in a matter of time where my family is not looking all over the world for me and you are not telling me and you don't feel obliged or obligated to tell my attorney or my 8-month pregnant wife where I am. That just seems un-American to me, unpatriotic, and not what we are about in this country. I could be wrong. And then I'm just saying, if they have the evidence, fine, then I will change it. But something is just not sitting right with this. And I don't understand why you're saying they have to have the goods because of the suspicion when they have not presented it so far. And that there's this whole big rigmarole going out around. And I think that they would want to tamp that down.
You've talked about Trump needing to show Canada respect.
President Trump.
President Trump, yes. President Trump needing to show Canada respect. You said that again just now. Are you not going to speak with President Trump until he cuts out this 51st state talk?
No, I look forward to speaking with President Trump, just to be clear. We respect the United States. We respect President Trump. President Trump has put some very important issues at the top of his agenda. We understand his agenda. We understand the importance of addressing the scourge of fentanyl, which is a challenge here in Canada as well as the United States. And I would say that the measures that have been put in place in recent weeks in Canada and Mexico, also the United States, means that we are making tremendous progress. I'll speak specifically for Canada, against fentanyl. We understand the importance President Trump places on American workers and American jobs. We want him and his administration to understand the importance we put on Canadian workers and Canadian jobs. And we will look for avenues to work together so that both objectives are met in terms of both our great economies, just as we are doing, and the people behind me have led this, just as we are doing with respect to the scourge of fentanyl.
Canada has officially sworn in a new prime minister. Mark Carney, a central banker turned politician, took his oath earlier today after the resignation of Canada's longtime leader, Justin Trudeau. Trudeau, who spent more than 9 years as prime minister, bid farewell and thanked Canadians on X, calling them the best country and the best people on earth. CNN's Paula Newton is here with more on this. So, Paula, Carney's background is in finance. It's not in politics, much like Trump's when he first became U.S. president. What kind of leader is he expected to be, and how can he handle this current trade crisis?
Well, I think in certain levels, in terms of style, much differently than Justin Trudeau. I think right down to the dark blue suit and the gray tie that he wore today to be sworn in, Brianna, there really was a contrast. This is an economist. He is a serious man. He did, I will say, go out of his way to point out the similarities with Donald Trump, that he has cut big deals in real estate, and that he did have some ties to the Trump administration in its first instance. I want you to listen now, though, to something that irks him and irks so many Canadians about the fact that the president continues to talk about the 51st state, and he explains why that will never happen. Listen.
I've been clear. Personally, I've been clear. The ministers behind me, I think, to an individual, when asked, have been clear that we will never, ever, in any way, shape, or form, be part of the United States. America is not Canada. Look at the ceremony we just have. You could not have had that ceremony. You would not have that ceremony in America. Look at the cabinet behind me. You would not have that cabinet in America. You do not have that cabinet in America. We are a very fundamentally different country.
Yeah, Brownie, before that, he actually said the words, in terms of Canada becoming the 51st state, it's crazy. His point is crazy. That's it. Now, part of this is obviously due to the fact that we are likely to be in an election campaign in Canada within the next few days. And this is really him standing up for nationalism, something that is definitely popular in Canada right now. But Brianna, you'll forgive the entire election campaign, because some days it will seem as if everyone is campaigning against U.S. President Donald Trump and not against each other, the politicians that will be running within just a few days.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. So he is now the first unelected prime minister in more than 40 years. That means he's not technically a part of parliament. For those who are not intimately familiar with the Canadian political process, how does that impact his duties and how he can carry them out as prime minister?
It doesn't affect his duties at all, but we always revolve around this word mandate. What does mandate mean? It means you want the people to elect you so that you have the full power, the full backing of the Canadian people. And whether you're in the Oval Office or anywhere else, you go there knowing that Canadians elected you. And that's why we will likely have an election campaign in Canada in the next few days. As I said, his style completely different. We did notice in the press conference, and he has been this way before. He can get a bit brittle and a bit short with questions. It'll be interesting to see how he campaigns and the pivot that he does make. As you said, from being a rookie politician, he is going to have to study up pretty quickly.
Yeah, can't be brittle in politics. Paula Newton, thank you so much for that report.
We asked parents who adopted teens to share their journey.
I think my biggest challenge was getting through to him to understand that love is real, and you have goals in mind, you have things that want to happen, and I want to help you get there.
Sometimes people tend to shy away from wanting to adopt teenagers because they feel like they've lost so much, but there's still so much to gain.
Just knowing that there's just that other person that cares and loves me out there, it feels great. And they've done so much for me, and I can only be appreciative every single day for just having them in my life.
I think it's been the best decision because I gained a son, and he's the best son ever. If I was down and out, he'd be there.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to learn more.
Farming is dangerous. There's dangers all around us. We work around it and we live around it every day. And we just become desensitized to what's around us.
We go through safety training and, you know, we try and do these things to make sure accidents don't happen, but you just never know.
There are so many farmers that I think take for granted all of the underground utilities that are there.
You don't want to hit a gas pipe because that's your life. The other part of it is if you hit certain things, you're liable for it.
I mean, we kind of know what's out here, but all at the same time, you just always call.
FarmSafe 811 starts with you. Whether you're installing drain tile or doing any sort of digging, always call 811 and wait for any underground lines to be marked and have the depth confirmed. That's farming with care. But if a line does get damaged, go somewhere safe and call 911.
Always keep safety in the back of your mind. Just stay humble.
For more information, go to farmsafe811.org.
In my opinion, Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States. Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Without U.S. military support, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. The United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration.
That's Richard Forer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. Noam Chomsky calls the Israel, U.S., and Palestine relationship a fateful triangle. He says, in no other region of the world are the problems so likely to lead to devastating regional conflict. He adds, those problems have only been aggravated by the irrationality and intolerance that has dominated discussion in the United States. It will be unfortunate, Chomsky warns, if this state of affairs persists. Chomsky wrote those words more than 50 years ago. The U.S. has given Israel hundreds of billions of dollars in aid over the years. In addition, Washington provides crucial diplomatic, political, and military support. Internationally, because of Gaza, both the U.S. and Israel are increasingly isolated. Moshe Yalon, former Israeli chief of staff and defense minister, says Israel is committing war crimes and ethnic cleansing. Our guest today is Richard Forer. He spent time in the West Bank and Gaza. He has Orthodox Jewish relatives living in West Bank settlements. He's a former member of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. He's the author of Wake Up, Essays on the Tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. I talked with Richard Forer at the Boulder Public Library in late March. I want to welcome Richard Forer to the program. Good to see you again, Richard. Anti-Semitism, what is it?
Well, traditionally, anti-Semitism was hatred of Jews because they were Jews. And now it's become, well, to quote Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which calls itself the largest Jewish civil rights organization in the world, Greenblatt specifically said anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. But really what he means is you're an anti-Semite if you are anti-Jewish supremacy. They're taking criticism of Israel to be anti-Semitic because Israel is a Jewish supremacist state, and it does not confer equal rights to all of its citizens, only to Jews. When I was growing up, and this applies to pretty much all Jews of my generation, and probably certainly generations before me, and probably generations after me, I thought Zionism was a movement to protect Jews from further persecution. So from that point of view, and not having studied the history, because most people haven't studied the history, I never did until 2006. I was ignorant. I thought Israel was an innocent country just trying to make peace with its Arab neighbors who were anti-Semitic. But from the point of view of someone who believes that Israel was a necessary haven from the perils of anti-Semitism, from thousands of years of persecution, I can understand why a Jewish person would react to criticism of Israel. However, the last 20 years or so, especially since Netanyahu has been prime minister, have shown just how cruel, insensitive, inhumane, and bigoted Israel is. So when people call us, anyone who criticizes Israel, we're basically ipso facto anti-Semites. What they're really doing is denying their own bigotry and projecting it onto us. I have a principle that I talk about in my book, which one of the universal principles I cite is that the real enemy is not someone or something outside of us. The real enemy is the unexamined mind that unconsciously projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. And so what people are doing when they call us anti-Semites, it's a reflex. They've never studied the history. They don't know us. They don't know what motivates us to criticize Israel, really, because they're too blind to our humanity. But what they are doing is, it's a reflex, so they don't have to consider the fact that their support for Israel is inhumane, that what they are doing is exactly what they are saying that we are doing and exactly what they would say the Nazis did. Okay, so they are trying to protect themselves from their own conscience and from their own inhumanity. For example, if Defense for Children International, and they're not the only organization, but they focus on children, when they speak about the suffering of children, the abuse of children by the Israeli military and by settlers, they're called anti-Semitic. We are called anti-Semites if we care about children. And so, for example, in my book, I talk about how Human Rights Watch said that Israel's treatment of children would terrify and traumatize any adult. So if I were to say that to a supporter of Israel, they would call me an anti-Semite. They would accuse me of belittling and slandering Israel. Anti-Semitism is not whether or not people who criticize Israel are anti-Semites. The real issue is what is going on in the minds of the accusers. They are the bigots who are projecting their bigotry onto us and calling us what is true of them.
So people like Norman Finkelstein, Noam Chomsky, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, yourself, are then put in a different category because you can't be anti-Semitic. You happen to be Jewish, so you're a self-hating Jew.
That, yes, although actually Jonathan Greenblatt, again, he referred to the JVP demonstrators in New York City, most of whom were Jewish, demonstrating against the genocide. He referred to them as anti-Semites. In other words, even if you're a Jew, you're an anti-Semite if you don't simply support what Israel is doing, if you don't remain blind and ignorant as Jonathan Greenblatt is. So that's why he's obviously an educated person, and yet he doesn't know anything about the history. And you know why he doesn't know anything about the history? Because he doesn't want to know anything about the history, because anything he would find out about the history would reflect upon his self-imagery. And it's self-imagery that is the heart of all of this suffering. That's the reason why, for example, I don't want to talk too much about him, but my identical twin brother cannot hear anything. To him, every Arab wants to kill every Jew. So he has a self-image of himself, as do most Jews, as being fair and humane people. I always thought I was fair and humane. I didn't think that I was a bigot. I didn't think that my criticism of Palestinians was because I was insensitive or prejudiced. I just thought they were psychopaths, okay? But they weren't. And speaking of that, Benny Morris, the famous Israeli historian, calls Palestinians serial killers and psychopaths. That's why, for him, his self-image does not require that he see all people as equal. His self-image includes the fact that Jews are superior. Most American Jews, certainly myself and my friends growing up, we never really saw ourselves as superior. Maybe we saw ourselves as a bit more moral than the Goyim who had tried to destroy the Jewish people. But we didn't think that we were prejudiced against Palestinians or Arabs. We just thought they were anti-Semites who wanted to destroy the state of Israel. And world Jewry, just like the Nazis had done. So it boils down to self-imagery. If you have a self-image of yourself as fair and humane, you're going to project and you support Israel. You're going to see Israel the way you see yourself. But what you are really not seeing is the real Israel. You are seeing a projection of Israel, of your idealistic images. That's what you're seeing. These people don't see Israel. They don't care about Israel. They see their self-imagery, and they see and they care about their own ego identity. They care about protecting and preserving this illusion that they have of who they are. And it's an illusion because they're not fair and humane. That is a belief system, as is the way they identify themselves. And the crux of the matter is, will people wake up and look in the mirror, or are they going to simply defend their own self-imagery, even in the face of thousands and thousands of children being killed, slaughtered, and other people dying?
Of Donald Trump, you write in your book that he has a history of Islamophobic and anti-Semitic pronouncements. Can you give some examples?
Yeah.
And what does that say about the political culture of the United States in 2025?
Yeah. Well, just 2 weeks ago, he called Chuck Schumer one of Israel's strongest supporters. He said that Chuck Schumer had become a Palestinian. But throughout his career, there was the Muslim ban. He'd wanted to prevent all Muslims from coming into the country. He was trashing Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib when he was president. He called for a database of every American Muslim, or I should say every Muslim living in the United States, and he wanted to surveil every mosque in the United States. And this is really probably just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, Trump believes what he's told by Miriam Adelson and Netanyahu and the prevailing beliefs of the neocons. He just believes it. Since he doesn't read anything, and since he doesn't contemplate anything, he just believes it. And of course, by believing it, he reaps monetary benefit, like he has from the Adelsons, for example.
Explain who Miriam Adelson is.
Okay, Miriam Adelson is the widow of Sheldon Adelson, who was a billionaire, casino owner, Las Vegas, Macau. And in 2016, the Adelsons gave $27 million directly to Trump's campaign and at least double that to the Republican National Committee on the condition that if Donald Trump were elected president, he moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which he did. And then Miriam Adelson, in the latest election against Kamala, Miriam Adelson put in over $100 million into a super PAC, and her condition was that Donald Trump, if elected president, recognize and allow Israel's annexation of the West Bank. Okay, which, by the way, Itamar Ben-Gavir, who's going to rejoin the Netanyahu coalition, since Netanyahu has violated phase two of the ceasefire, Itamar Ben-Gavir just introduced a bill in the Knesset to void the Oslo Accords, the Y River Memorandum, and the Hebron Protocols, which gave some land to the Palestinians. So he wants to eliminate the legal basis for the Palestinians being on some of this land as a prelude to annexation. And exactly 1 year ago, Bezalel Smotrich, who's in the coalition, the Minister of Finance, who was also in charge of the occupation of the West Bank, 1 year ago, they the State of Israel seized 3.8 square miles of Palestinian land in the West Bank, the largest seizure of land since the Oslo Accords. And of course, the Oslo Accords, the land giveaway was Area C, for the most part, which is 61% of the West Bank and is under Israeli administrative and military control. What we're seeing now is not just the inevitable, predictable violation of the ceasefire. And Tamir Pardo, Israel's former Mossad chief, just said that Netanyahu violated the ceasefire because he doesn't care about the Israeli people. He only cares about retaining his position as prime minister. So he doesn't
and
have
that
to go
position would be threatened because he's charged with criminal activities.
Well, he's charged with criminal activities, but also killing people in Gaza and attacking Gaza. It's much harder for the Knesset to call for elections. He also knows that by doing it, he's keeping Bezalel Smotrich in the coalition. So when Netanyahu signed the ceasefire under Trump's orders in January, and Trump told him he could do whatever he wanted after phase one, but when Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire, Itamar Ben-Gvir left the coalition and took his Knesset votes with him. But Gideon Saar entered the coalition, so Netanyahu still had a majority in the Knesset. Bezalel Smotrich, though, told Netanyahu, I will stay in the coalition under these conditions. And the conditions were, which Netanyahu loved, you cannot proceed beyond phase one. You cannot continue to phase two. You have to attack. Number two, you have to give me greater authority to expand settlements in the West Bank and to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. And this is exactly what they're doing. A week or two ago, Israel, maybe it was 3 weeks ago, in Jenin mostly, Israel expelled over 40,000 Palestinians and said, you're never going to come back. I don't know where they went. And then they've invaded other Tokaram, and they invaded areas of Nablus. And this is just a process. This is the inevitable conclusion of the Zionist project, which was always based on the world is anti-Semitic, and the only way we Jews can live in peace is to get rid of the Goyim. So this is the inevitable conclusion. They want to expel the Palestinians. And the amazing thing is that their greatest supporters are anti-Semites, the Christian evangelicals, who believe that Jews have to go to hell unless they become Christians when Jesus returns. And Theodor Herzl predicted this. Theodor Herzl said that the anti-Semites will become our best friends. And that was pretty much true from the beginning, because Herzl called religious Jews kikes, which is about the worst word you can use for a Jew. He said they were disgusting, unspeakable. If you read Theodor Herzl's comments about religious Jews, if you didn't know it was Herzl, you would think it was Adolf Hitler. But what Herzl understood was that the religious Jews detested Zionism, because to the religious Jews, only God, through the Moshiach from the house of King David, only the Moshiach can create a Jewish state. A Jewish state cannot be created by man. Zionism is blood and soil, just like the Nazis. Zionism is a nationalistic movement to create a Jewish state without regard to the Torah. So Herzl was an atheist. He didn't circumcise his son. He told the Pope, he literally told the Pope, that if the Pope would help him find a piece of land for the Jewish people, he would have them converted to Roman Catholicism. So my point is that the Zionist movement from the very beginning was supported by the Christian Zionists. Christian Zionism preceded Jewish Zionism, because the Christian Zionists wanted the Jews to leave. They wanted them out of Europe. So that's why Theodor Herzl was saying that the anti-Semites would be the Jews' best friends. And so this is really what has happened. During World War II, Yitzhak Shamir, who was the head of the Stern Gang and became prime minister after Menachem Begin, who was the head of the Irgun, Jewish terrorist gangs, Shamir's people went to the Nazis and said, look, you believe in the Aryan race, that they're superior. We believe Jews are superior. You want to get rid of the Jews? Fine. Send them to us. Send them to Palestine. So there was always this kind of connection in a perverse way between Zionism and Nazism. And as the U.S. State Department said in 1944, they are very similar. They are both based on blood and soil.
Blutenboden, I think, is the German. Now, Gábor Máté is a very interesting figure. He's a Hungarian-born Jew. He's a physicist, author. He's based in Vancouver, British Columbia. And in a recent alternative radio program, he talked about how can Jews of all people support and rationalize genocide. And then you respond, what people really want to know is why? Why do my relatives who always have supported civil rights, why do they support Israel? Why do rabbis who talk about Jewish values and tikkun olam, you can translate that, that's Hebrew, why do they support Netanyahu and Jewish supremacy? Why?
T- Tikkun Olam is healing the world. There's another term in Judaism called Dira Betach Tonim, which is to make a dwelling place for the divine. So from the point of view of certain Hasidic Jewish sects, the reason the Jews are chosen is to make the world a dwelling place for the divine. But these sects are among the most virulently anti-Palestinian. So they are obviously misunderstanding the wisdom of their own teachings, because they are taking their teachings and making their teachings conform to their ego rather than surrendering their ego to the wisdom of the teachings. But in answer to that question, it's all about self-imagery. From the very beginning, Israel accused the Arabs, Nasser in particular, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the head of Egypt. From the very beginning, they accused the Arabs of wanting to finish what the Nazis had started. And even today, you will constantly hear Knesset members, rabbis, refer to Arabs or Palestinians as Nazis. And so they have this image as Nazis. So that's why my answer to Gabor Mate, the reason people support all these horrors is because they think they're just defending themselves from Nazis. And it's the same reason they don't believe. For the most part, they either don't believe that Israel is literally, deliberately killing children and unarmed civilians. They think that's another slur. But even those who believe it, well, then they'll rationalize it. I've heard people, and it's more Israeli Jews than American Jews, because Israeli Jews are really brought up from birth to see the Palestinians as a mortal threat to them. Okay, but I have seen articulate Israelis on YouTube say things like, if I could push a button right now and kill every single Palestinian, I would do it. And I think most Jews in Israel would do it too. I've heard people say that stuff. And there are, Al Jazeera has compiled a list of at least 2,500 videos from Jewish soldiers bragging about killing children and killing civilians. That little girl, there's a human rights organization in Belgium named after her, and they submitted a brief to the International Court of Justice with 1,000 names and videos of Israeli soldiers bragging about murdering children and other civilians as part of the case against Israel, against Netanyahu and Gallant, and there should be others, for genocide. But again, it all boils down to self-imagery. We see the world through the prism of our ego, or of our ego identity, our self-imagery. This is why it's impossible for so many Jews to believe that even Netanyahu, that even their leaders could possibly do to the Palestinians or to anyone what has been done to them. They just cannot see it because it's not even a part of their frame of reference. It's almost like the Native Americans when the ships first came to the New World in the 1400s. They didn't see them because they had no concept. And they were out in the ocean and they could not see that there were ships there. They saw the men when they approached and entered the shore, but they couldn't see the ships. It's very similar to that.
Discuss, too, the paradox of victims becoming persecutors.
One of the things that was really central to Israel's establishment was power. Israel always knew, or at least thought they knew, that they had to have immense power so that nobody could ever screw the Jews again like the Nazis had and like the Russian Cossacks had with all the pogroms for the years and all the other enemies of the Jews throughout history, many of whom, it's fictitious. A lot of the history has been debunked. But yes, the Cossacks, in particular the Ukrainians, and the Nazis, of course, were extremely cruel to Jews. So in their trauma and the need to create a Jewish state, they determined that they had to have immense power so no one could screw with them again. But what is really amazing is the vast majority of Jews didn't want a Jewish state. Okay, it was only because the Zionist organizations prevented Western Europe and the United States from taking in Jews after the Holocaust that Israel was able to become a state, because the Jews had nowhere to go. They were forced to go to Palestine. In 1947, 55,000 Jews applied to European Jews applied to immigrate to the United States. And the vast, vast majority of them said that if they couldn't go to the United States, they'd go anywhere but Israel, but Palestine. Okay, so there was this great... So it was a con job by the Zionist movement. They conned the world into establishing Israel, and they conned the Jewish people, or forced the Jewish people, a lot of the Jewish people to go there, so there would be a large enough population that the UN would vote for a partitioned Jewish state, which was the prelude to the establishment in 1948 of the State of Israel.
Angela Davis once told me, victimization cannot be permitted to function as a halo of innocence. Is that operative in this instance?
What I should say, if you have the self-image of yourself as a victim, you will draw events to yourself, or you will interpret events in a way that confirms to yourself that you really are a victim. In the case of Israelis, they're victims, they're perpetrators, and all of this has to do with the stories they've told themselves about Jewish persecution, in particular, the Holocaust. Gabor Mate talks about trauma a lot, and I agree with him, but a lot of the trauma is self-traumatization. Israelis are traumatizing themselves with the stories they tell themselves. Okay, you know, when you grow up as a kid and you're taught by your school teachers, probably your parents, and certainly the government, that the world hates Jews, that you have to protect yourselves against the Palestinians because they're serial killers and psychopaths. That's why you need a wall. That's why you need to confine them. That's why you need to keep ethnically cleansing them to get rid of them. When you're taught all that from the time you're a little child, it becomes self-evident to you. That's how you're going to see the Palestinians. Not only that, it's not even something that you could even question. It's kind of like a lot of people automatically take for granted that there's a God and that you're going to go to heaven. And it's something they don't even question. It's certainly something they've never inquired into, you know, within themselves. They just believe it because they were taught it as children, and they cannot conceive that anything other than that could be true.
The younger generation, at least in the United States, of Jews seems to be struggling to establish some distance with the state of Israel. I'm thinking of Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, and then the actions, for example, occupying the Trump Tower in New York, Grand Central Station in New York, demonstrations in D.C. There seems to be some ferment there. What's causing that?
The younger generation is farther removed from the horrors of the Holocaust, number one. Number two, they've probably interacted more with Muslims and Arabs, because there's a lot of Muslims and Arabs in this country now. And also, they are a majority. I mean, Jews under the age of 40 in this country, a majority, oppose what Israel is doing. How long that can continue or how effective that can be under Trump, I don't know, because they're starting to arrest people. I predict that there's going to be a lot more violence in this country. I actually think that Trump would like to see more violence in this country against people that he opposes, against people who don't vote for him. Okay, and I can see that it's possible that as these demonstrations, if they continue, that there will be more violence. You know, just like there was violence on UCLA's campus, which, by the way, a lot of Hasidic Jews started the violence. A lot of most of the demonstrators against the genocide on the UCLA campus were peaceful. And then a bunch of Hasidic Jews and police came in, and they started the violence there, just as there was a lot of violence started by non-demonstrators at Columbia.
So. I'm going to interject a poem here that I think speaks to this moment that we're in. It's from Pastor Martin Niemöller. He was part of the anti-Nazi German resistance. He was imprisoned from 1937 to 1945. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me. And there was no one left to speak out for me. A poem for this moment. You're listening to Richard Fohrer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. And another poem that I'd like to read is from the Palestinian national poet, Mahmoud Darwish. It's called "The Earth is Closing In on Us." The earth is closing in on us, pushing us through the last passage. Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Mahmoud Darwish was a great poet who died a few years ago, and this is one of his most important poems. Let's talk a little bit about Hamas. In 2006, there was an election, which you write in your book, resulted in a resounding upset for Hamas. They won 74 out of 132 seats. You noted international monitors certified the election as free and transparent, while voters viewed Hamas as relatively incorrupt. But they viewed Fatah, that is PLO, as Israel's subcontractor in occupied territory. So talk about Hamas and how it's, in a way, a product of the conflict, the occupation.
Yes.
It may surprise some to learn that Israel supported Hamas in its early days.
Well, Israel helped create Hamas. During the First Intifada in 1987, Israel collaborated with the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt to create Hamas because they wanted a religious alternative to Fatah. Israel was threatened by the nonviolent civil disobedience of the First Intifada. In the first year of the First Intifada, the Palestinians demonstrated. They passed out leaflets. It was a nonviolent movement.